got his own bodies after the recent attack on Salman Rushdie, we thought we'd bring you my full-length interview with him from 1995. Welcome to another classic LNL, tonight a one-hour special with the multi-prize-winning author, Sir now, Salman Rushdie. We taped this interview in November 1995, at a time when Rushdie was arguably the best-known writer on Earth, due to the interesting critical reaction to The Satanic Verses, which is his fourth novel, published 7 years earlier. As you know, its contents resulted in death threats, the issue of a fatwa from the supreme leader of Iran at the time, Ayatollah Khomeini, a fatwa which has been reiterated many times since. But in 1995, Rushdie was still living underground, appearing only sporadically in public. Time now to sit back and enjoy this classic, Classic LNL.
Welcome to another week of LNL. I belong to a couple of struggling free speech organisations who have recently put their tiny membership lists and their kitty together. Mm-hmm. We have these sad meetings, Salman, where we're sitting around discussing what we could do to actually get the debate going, and we decided we're going to write you a letter. We were going to invite you to Australia, and here, lo and behold, as if by magic, before we could put the letter in the mail, here you are. You are, of course, not only the most famous writer in the world, but you're probably the most famous novelist there's ever been, if you think about it, with the possible exception of Alan Demidenko. I mean, even at the height of his powers, Hugo wouldn't have been as widely known as you are now, would he?
Well, it's a question of known for what, really. I suspect that, and I certainly one of the problems for me has been that you're right. I mean, probably every taxi driver in the world would respond in some way to my name, but it doesn't mean they've ever seen a sentence that I've written,
or have any great desire to say do.
No, exactly. So it's a curious kind of of fame.
It's and not one that you would have wished, in other words.
Absolutely not. There's very little pleasure in it, oddly. And I think what has happened is that because of the incredible attention paid to me in these years, it gives me a certain ability to do one or two things. I mean, for instance, you were talking about free speech organizations, and I've tried to involve myself with quite a few such campaigns over these years. And because my name being attached to such a campaign tends to attract the media and so on, it means that I can, if you like, put back in a little of all the attention that I was given and that helped me to talk about other problems.
I would have thought that the burden of this preposterous, unprecedented level of fame would be another form of fatwa, in a way. It must be almost as oppressive.
Well, I don't feel that, really. I really don't feel that. I mean, largely because until quite recently, it's been very difficult for me to get around and really experience any of it. it's one thing to be very well known. It's another to be so sequestered that really it's impossible to have any sense of that. And it's been it's been rather pleasurable to be in the last couple of years when I've been able to get out and about more, to see how much sympathy and solidarity and kind of friendship and interest there has been, because I can say that in these wanderings about, and indeed when I've just been walking down a street or in a park or something, I mean, people do recognize me and come up to me and so on. And so far, 100% of those encounters has been incredibly friendly. And that's been very important to me, because in the years when I was not able to do that, it was very easy to lose a sense of how people were feeling about this. It was very easy to think that maybe people didn't care that much about it.
Well, you're sort of beatified and demonized, aren't you?
That did happen, yes. And I think both of them have their problems, both of those things. And what I've been trying to do is to is to scrape that stuff away and try and reintroduce myself.
Well, here you are, as I said, by magic, sitting in I must apologise for being one of the world's smallest studios, not our usual studio. It's after your years of claustrophobia, it doesn't seem particularly hospitable. But I was once interviewing Julian Barnes, and we'd been chatting away about Flaubert's Parrot and other things, and I asked him the following question. I said, Julian, why do you really write? And a little hush fell, you know, quite a long silence, and he sort of stared into the middle distance. And finally he says, because I'm afraid of dying. And it was as if, he said to me later, that he'd never really thought it through, and that was the moment he chose to confront it. If I put the same question to you, why do you really write?
Well, I think one of the things that made me want to write was because I love to read. And I think many writers would say that they had come towards writing because of a love of reading. I mean, not all writers. There are some who hardly read a book. But certainly for me, when I was a kid, I would say, I want to be a writer. And what I meant by that was that I liked reading books. You know, because, of course, when you're a child, you have no idea what it is to be a writer. But you have an idea what it is to be a reader.
So there was no cosmic preoccupation. It wasn't a sort of an attempt to ward off mortality.
I don't think so. But I think what it is, the way I would see it now, is that it's my way of having a conversation with the world. You know, and that's there's an internal conversation that goes on inside all of us, you know, all the time, about how we think about things and where we think things are at the moment. And the great gift of being a writer is that you can externalize that internal conversation. I mean, if you can find stories to tell and ways of doing it, you can offer to others your take on the world at a given moment. So, I mean, I've always seen books as being like interim reports, you know, from the writer's consciousness, and where you say, here's how I see it now. And I mean, in a couple of years' time, I might see things rather differently, but right now, this is what I have to talk about. I think I've always been a very talkative person, and I think...
And you talk on paper.
And I talk on paper.
What happens when people talk back? I've got a lovely little postcard that someone gave me with a postage stamp on it, and it was sent by Bernard Shaw to quite a famous Australian writer who he'd never heard of. But as well as the handwritten edition by GBS, it's got a little printed message saying, Mr. Shaw is far too busy to respond to your letters or read your manuscripts in the hours, perhaps minutes, left to him. I mean, you must nonetheless get an immense amount of mail, for good or ill.
Yeah, I mean, I'm well known as one of the world's worst correspondents.
Take note of that, listener. It's no point writing to him. This is not an invitation to write to Rushdie.
No, but I mean, as against that, it has meant a great deal to me in these years to receive letters from strangers, you know, of sympathy and solidarity. And I may say, really, a very high proportion of those letters from Australia.
Well, they're a form of love letter. I want to talk about love later because, you know, you have such a comprehensive oceanic view of love and all its tributaries. But before we do that, let's just sort of circle around a bit. I want to talk to you about freedom of speech. Yes, you're right. You're on a great many of the appropriate committees, and you've given good service to them. In this country, it seems to some of us that freedom of speech is no longer all that fashionable, and it's being nibbled away at by people who were once its friends. PC is simply one manifestation of it, I think. But there are a lot of people who, for various ideological reasons, don't like it so much or want to limit it. Now, we've even got anti-vilification legislation in Australia now, in a country which, I must say, I don't think has a desperate need for it. How do you feel about the limits to freedom of speech, having tested them?
Yeah,
so
well,
often?
I mean, I must say I find disturbing exactly the phenomenon you describe, which is not confined to Australia, in which various pressure groups with whom, broadly speaking, one may personally agree, whether they be anti-racist groups or women's groups or whatever it may be, that these groups have come to think of, or some groups have come to think of censorship as a weapon they would wish to use. And so suddenly you find, if you like, a pressure for censorship coming from the left of society, joining the permanent pressure for censorship that exists on the right of society. And I do think that freedom of speech and these great issues are getting squeezed in the middle of this kind of pincer movement.
Don't we have to continue to take the risk of freedom?
I think that's very, very important. And I think one of the arguments that I have tried to use is that anybody who looks for 5 minutes at the history of free speech will see that the first people who are threatened by censorship are minority groups. I mean, that these are the people who are denied the right to speak, historically, are the ones who are in the minority. And it's a kind of tragic irony if minority groups seek now to espouse censorship for their own reasons, because then when the time comes and somebody wants to shut them up, they won't have an argument, because they will have joined the enemy.
It's so easy, isn't it, to offer that freedom, this precious freedom, to people with whom one agrees. Mm-hmm. It's much harder to offer it to people you detest.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, but it seems to be the test of the free speech argument begins at the point at which people start saying things you don't like.
Mm.
Because it is, as you say, it's no trick to agree with people and let them say so.
I've come to this position having had a bout with authoritarianism as a kid. I joined a very nasty political party, which will remain nameless, and was then all for preparing an index. It's only since I left the Communist Party that I sort of realised the error of my ways. Were you always liberal?
No, I mean, I think I've, in a way, come a little bit from the other direction. I mean, when I was younger, I spent a lot of my time, my free time, involved in anti-racist activity. And I mean, I can remember falling prey to the argument that you've got to prevent people saying certain kinds of things, you know, because they're horrible things.
It's very easy, isn't it?
Very easy, because they are absolutely horrible things, and you don't want... You don't like the idea of the Ku Klux Klan marching up and down your city streets, talking their rubbish, you know, mouthing their evil slogans. But I have come to the conclusion that a really free society must tolerate these things. They must tolerate these absolutely appalling utterances. I had to face an extraordinary case of it myself, which is that soon after the attack against me began, there was a movie made in Pakistan.
Of course, I'd forgotten that,
yes. Called International Guerrillas, in which I was portrayed not only as somebody wearing a rather revolting range of cerise safari suits, but also as a drunkard, an abuser of drugs, a torturer, a sadist, a murderer. And the film...
A bit over the top, isn't it?
Just a little bit, you know. I mean, that's not what my mother thinks. And opposed to me were the heroes of the film, who were basically international terrorists whose job it was to kill me.
Mm.
And at the end of the film, indeed, I was rather grotesquely killed. Now, when this film arrived in England and was looking for a certificate, it was banned by the British Board of Film Classification because they were afraid that I would take legal action, which, of course, I would have been entirely entitled to do. And I found myself in the bizarre situation of having to write to the board to waive any illegal rights that I might have, and to say, would you please give this film a certificate, because I do not wish to be protected by an act of censorship. And actually, it was a wonderful little parable, this, of the free speech position, because had that film not been given a certificate, it would have become a great kind of cursed classic. You know,
the
video of this film would have become very hot stuff, and so on. As it was, they licensed it, and the next week, in Bradford, the city with the largest Muslim population, the producers booked the biggest cinema in town, and nobody went.
Nobody went. Yes, the centre is often the greatest publicist.
Yeah.
He or she.
You're listening to A Classic LNL on Radio National, Radio Australia, the web and your pod, to a chat with Salman Rushdie, recorded in 1995. At that time, he just released The Moor's Last Sigh.
I had sort of half expected that the bloke that walked into the studio would be as pale as a vampire, you know, that he'd be shrinking from the sun. How have you kept, I mean, your mental health is clear from the writing, how have you kept so physically healthy?
I think I'm just really lucky, you know, and it was one of the things that worried me in the early days of this, that you know, what would happen to my health. And I've always been reasonably, I mean, touch wood, reasonably healthy, even though I more or less do nothing about it, you know, every so often I get on an exercise bike, but otherwise, forget it, really. And in spite of this, I mean, really the only health problems I've had in this, apart from having to have a wisdom tooth removed, was that I've developed a mild case of asthma. But other than that, I've just, somehow, my health has held up. And I do think that's, I find it difficult to explain. I went to a doctor a couple of years ago and had various tests, and the doctor was, I think, rather depressed to find so little evidence of stress or so on. So I don't know. I must be stupid, I guess.
Well, your health and both physical and mental health has survived fatwas and fame. Do you still love writing, or is it increasingly a burden?
No, I mean, I almost fell out of love with it, to tell you the truth, for the first time in my life when this thing happened to me. Because one writes, most writers would say that they feel most themselves when writing. They feel more themselves sometimes than they do in the rest of their lives. And that you write from what you think of as your best self, or from certainly the whole of yourself. And having done that, I mean, having spent with this, on the Satanic Verses more than 5 years on doing that, to have in response the kind of ugliness that came my way, did for a moment make me feel that maybe the game was not worth the candle, you know, and that if this was what you got in return for doing all that, then why do it? You know, be a postman, be a plumber, do something useful. And there was a moment there where, for the first and really only time in my life, I actually seriously considered the possibility of not
being a plumber.
Yeah, of not being a writer. You know, and that was a very black moment for me. And in the end, you know, in the end, I suppose I discovered that it is my job. You know, it's just my.
Well, we're all delighted to hear this, Simon. I mean, plumbing and things like this are fine professions, but yes, there are plenty that do it. I notice, however, that your speed of writing has increased by a couple of orders of magnitude. Satanic Verses took you yonks, didn't it?
Yeah, 5 years or so.
Where the new book was a sprint, comparatively.
Well, it was a sprint in the end. You know, I mean, actually, it is 5 years between the completion of Haroon and the Sea of Stories and The Moor's Last Sigh. It's more or less exactly 5 years. But, of course, that was a very interrupted 5 years for me, including the fact that I was involved in all this political campaigning, which, believe me, takes up an enormous amount of time, and the visible stuff is just the tip of a long iceberg of time. So there was a long period of maybe 3 years when I was having to write The Moor's Last Sigh in kind of scraps in between other kinds of work, and that's a very unsatisfactory way to write a book, and I had no sense of whether I actually had a book there or not.
I've got filmmaker friends who, in fact, view the world cinematically. Mm. When they get into a lift or a taxi, they're seeing it on a screen. Mm-hmm. They're seeing it through a lens. I am now in medium close-up.
Yes. You know,
zoom out to show me in the city street.
Yeah.
Writers, of course, are often as obsessed and are writing constantly. Do you find yourself doing that?
Yes. I mean, I think I write. I mean, I do have a need to, first of all, to do some writing every day. I mean, even if it may only be just jotting down notes.
It's like a singer doing the scales, is
yes,
it?
Yes, I think you really do need to keep up the rhythm of writing. You do need to keep your hand in. You know, if you stop, it actually does take an extraordinary and frustrating amount of time to start again. So
yeah,
but
that's a discipline. I'm wondering whether, in fact, as a writer, you're constantly sort of looking at rooms.
Yeah, you're always looking for stuff. You're always listening to people and stealing bits of their dialogue. If somebody tells you a joke, you file it away.
We were talking about you and the team and about the extraordinary breadth and depth of imagination, and I suggested that you were an athlete of imagination. And I wonder whether in this form of athleticism there are specific honing skills. I mean, writing's writing, but your sort of discursive imagination is almost without precedent in modern letters. Does that require a different sort of procedure?
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, my imagination is my imagination, and that makes it easier for me to use it, you know, because it's mine. And that's to say, the stuff kind of comes out like that naturally. And at some level is not forced, you know, it just, that's the way in which it tumbles out. But what I have, I think, I hope what has happened to me over the years is that I've learned more control. That if I look now at Midnight's Children, Midnight's Children is a book begun more or less 20 years ago, and it has, for me, all the benefits and problems of youth. I mean, it's a very young man's book. And I hope that this book, in this book, I actually thought what would be wonderful is if I could recapture the kind of level of energy of Midnight's Children, but with some more linguistic control, and that's what I tried to do.
Yes, I was trying to find a quote about Midnight's Children where it was suggested by a writer or a critic that you'd fulfilled the potential that no one knew you had with the first book.
Well, it was a second book. I had a dreadful and
There was a previous
yes, there was
one,
a kind of appalling first novel that I more or less have disowned since. But the truth is, Midnight Children was not even my second novel because I wrote several books that never saw the light of day. You know, I think
what the manuscripts would be worth at Sotheby's now.
Yes, except that they more or less all embarrass me. You know, so there are about three unpublished novels written to some degree of finish.
Now the publisher's sitting on the other side of the screen. They're waving his hands in the air, looking wildly excited. Settle down, Kate. it's sad to hear that, and they'll never see the light of day.
I don't think so. I mean, I did, of course, cannibalize them for their best bits, and Midnight Children does contain some material that originally was written in these other invisible books. So in fact, it was the fifth novel I completed, although only the second that I published.
One measure of your fame is that there are actually jokes about you. And one of the jokes, which is still sort of wandering around the internet, is that your novel after Satanic Verses was going to be Buddha, You Fat Fool.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you skipped that one, but you've moved on to another target. You've now gone into fundamentalism. You really are a troublemaker, aren't you?
Well, I think I would say that fundamentalists are the troublemakers. I just happen to notice that they exist. I mean, it's a question of what you call trouble. You know, it seems to me that to introduce a kind of fascist politics into a country is making trouble on a much higher level than writing a novel which notices that it exists. What I do think is that I've always tried to be a writer of public fiction as well as private fiction. And that's just my take on the world. I studied history, I suppose, rather than literature, and that's always given me an interest in literature that has a historical sense. And from Midnight's Children through Shame, the Satanic Verses, and the Moor's Last Side, there has been that public project as well as everything else. You know, so if you do that, if you want to take on the great issues of the time, if you want to confront abuses of power, then every so often the people that you take on don't like it. And I think, you know, when I wrote Shame, I was in part writing about a military dictatorship that was still in power in Pakistan, and not surprisingly, the military dictator didn't like the book. But imagine how embarrassing it would have been if he had liked it.
Mm.
And similarly, in this case, I mean, first of all, just to be clear, the novel has had a reception in India which certainly surpasses anything that's happened to me since Midnight's Children. And in many cases, the reviews and the readers' responses have been better than what happened to Midnight's Children.
Yes, I must say, you're being more energetically and favourably reviewed at the moment than you've been for a while.
For quite a while, yeah. And that's very nice. That feels like some kind of pleasant return. You know, I think everything does come around again. But so the political issue.
You say that. Yeah, I've often heard you say that about things coming around again. You believe that, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very, very true about a literary career. You know, I mean, it happens to every writer in the world that you arrive on the scene, you have something new to say, or a new way of saying something.
Mm.
Everybody gets excited. People give you lots of praise. They, if you're lucky, they kind of throw gongs and sashes at you.
And then
there
you fall out of the aeroplane, don't you?
Yes, there begins to be, or there can begin to be, a kind of boredom, if you like. People say, oh, well, we've heard that tune, sing us another tune. And then if you sing them another tune, they say, well, that's not like the tune you sang last time. So it can become a kind of no-win situation. And I suppose, for me, I had a very good ride for a very long time. And the bumpiest moment in that ride was the Satanic Verses, but I mean, not for the obvious reasons, actually just in literary critical terms. It was probably the most mixed reception any book of mine ever had.
But someone, you had a reputation for being a bit of a handful. Do you think that perhaps you are, just as you've maintained your physical health, do you think perhaps you might even be a bit nicer now?
I don't know. I mean, my friends say I was nice to begin with. You know? The problem is that if you are a writer like me who wants to be a part of the argument about the world he lives in, and therefore who, not just in his writing, but outside his fiction, you know, takes up positions, writes essays, etc., well, I mean, that inevitably...
You make enemies,
you
don't
just
you?
Gets up people's noses.
Of course. And you judge yourself by the quality of your enemies to some extent, don't you?
Well, I think, you know, the people who are in the opposite camp are people I wouldn't particularly like to have in mind.
You're listening to A Classic LNL on Radio National, Radio Australia, the internet, and your pod. to an interview with the British writer Sir Salman Rushdie, recorded in 1995. Here he talks about fundamentalism and what he regards as the most important thing in the world, that is, love. Sad to see that the marriage recently broke up.
The way you get involved in the issues, apart from the fiction, is careful. You don't hop into the details of a political skirmish, do you? Seem to take the view that the writer should be at a remove, committed but not too deeply involved.
Yes, I'm a bad joiner, you know. I mean, in spite of having very strong political opinions, I've never joined a political party.
Never?
No. No. I mean, I've always voted for a particular party, political party, which is the Labour Party, but I've never joined it. And I think I think the thing that is to be treasured in writers is that nobody owns them, you know, and that they simply say what they have to say, and they're nobody's man. You know, and I've therefore felt the need to try and preserve
perhaps
that.
Perhaps they shouldn't be, but many are.
Many are. But I mean, anyway, that's the position I've tried to have, which is I just say my piece, you know, and people can like it or not like it, but at least it's my piece. It's not in somebody else's service.
Mm. You have an enormous interest in history, as you were saying. Your training is historical rather than literary, mm-hmm. and you use history as a force in almost everything you write. History is almost a character,
yes,
isn't it? Let's get back to fundamentalism. It would seem at the moment, if you take a snapshot of the world, that fundamentalism in all its ugly forms is having a boom time, you know, whether it's Christian fundamentalism in the US, whether it's the various forms of fundamentalism in the Middle East, mm-hmm. India, etc. With your knowledge of history, is this perhaps an illusion? Is fundamentalism simply where it's always been, what it's always at?
No,
or
I think it's a bad time. And I mean, I think it would be nice to be able to say that things aren't as bad as they seem, but actually I think they probably are as bad as they seem.
Why are they? What are the forces?
I would first of all say that fundamentalism for me is a political movement, not a religious movement. I mean, the purpose of fundamentalism is power. It has nothing particular to say theologically.
That's like saying rape is about power rather than sex. It's that sort of distinction.
No, I mean, I think rape is about both sex and power. But I think there's even many Islamic fundamentalists would say that they describe themselves as a political movement, you know, and a movement which seeks to take over the state. I guess what I think is that any such movement arises out of the ashes of another failure. And one of the things I think is that in the 20th century, people were sold a kind of myth of progress. People were told that things would get better. And a great deal of the whole modern project in society has been predicated on that idea of progress. And along with that, there comes the major philosophical idea of the 20th century, which is uncertainty. Suddenly we've all, even scientists, have principles of uncertainty now. So we have learned very carefully during the century not to be too sure of anything, to question everything, to doubt things, to be skeptical. And the reward for this was supposed to be that things would progress as a result, that we would get better and better slowly. Instead, what's happened is that basically things have not got better. You know, the poor have not got less poor, the rich have continued to get more rich. And for many people in many societies of the world, the promise of the secular modern society didn't work out. And then all you're left with is these doubts and uncertainties which seem to leave you kind of directionless. Into this vacuum, there arrives a much simpler idea, which says here is what's right and wrong, and here's what's good and bad, and these people we will follow, and those people we will kill. And suddenly, in the middle of this confusion of the modern period, people see this as a kind of life raft. People see it as a twig to clutch onto. And I think that's a part of what's happening.
It seems to me they don't simply clutch onto it. They help build the raft. Now, you can get some quite curious forms of fundamentalism. And one of them is, and I just pluck one out of the air, the growing American belief in alien abductions and the colonic irrigation that takes place in UFOs.
Yeah.
Now, people don't just believe it, they participate,
yes,
in belief,
true.
Don't they? They
that's
add true. To the, they contribute their personal accounts.
That's true.
it seems to me that this is different, that there's this feverish desire to believe. I mean, I suspect that both you and I would have a long list of disbeliefs, mm-hmm. at least as many, probably more than beliefs.
Sure.
But other people do want to believe.
They do. And I think there is a great need in people to know what they are for as well as to know what they're against. And to an extent, I understand that very well, because when what happened to me happened, I understood rather quickly that in order to survive this experience, I actually needed to decide what I was fighting for and not just what I was fighting against. It's rather easy when you're the subject of terrorist attack, of this kind of violence, to define what you're against.
Well, what you seem to be for is a four-letter word, love.
Yeah, I think that's enough of an old hippie to think that all you need is love.
You don't seem to differentiate between the plethora of loves. To you, they are all overlapping.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I think the Moore's Last Sigh is at its centre is a novel about these kinds of love. I mean, it's not whether it's the love of lovers or the love of parents and children or the love of God or the love of country or whatever it might be. And it tries to discuss how it is that love operates in our lives. And one of the things that I felt was emerging as I wrote the book was the idea of, was a kind of metaphorical idea of love as being parallel to something I think about society in a larger sense. That's to say, what happens to us when we fall in love, characteristically, is that we drop our boundaries. You know, we stop being so sealed off from each other, and we lower the frontiers. You know, we bring the defenses down, and we, in some sense, flow into each other. You know, the other person becomes a part of us and shapes us, and we do the same to the other. And this is the great beauty of being in love, is that you permit this. You permit this openness and vulnerability and defenselessness, which, of course, is what makes the failure of love so painful, because there you are in a situation which is completely defenseless. Nevertheless, it seemed that there was a parable here, if you like, about society, about how a similar beauty in society is when differing parts of it agree to lower those barriers, when they agree to drop the defenses and come together. And since one of the things that my writing has always been about is that kind of blending, that kind of mélange, it turned out, writing this book, that love itself became a kind of metaphor of that mélange.
David Putnam once told me that God was his executive producer, that Lou Grade also told me this. They told me the same dinner. And I thought, then they went on to catastrophes. But it sometimes seems to me that perhaps she is on your side, because this novel begins with the most wonderful gift to you, the story of the painting of your mother.
Yeah.
I mean, for heaven's sake, you wouldn't almost dare write that.
No, I must say, I really did feel that. I mean, there are stories of great literary gifts. There's a famous story of Pushkin inviting Gogol round for tea and giving him the plot of Dead Souls. telling him that he'd had this really good idea,
but he
couldn't use it himself, but he felt it would be just right for Gogol. And Gogol had the brains to realize that Pushkin was right and went away and wrote this great masterpiece.
But you're always on the phone, aren't you, ringing up other writers saying, look,
yeah,
here's a terrific,
yes, here's a great story, yes,
it.
Here's a great idea for a masterpiece, Hazel, exactly, yeah. Anna Karenina, this great idea for a character called Bovary. but what happened was that I simply received a letter from a painter that I knew, an Indian painter called Krishan Khanna, who is now in his 70s and a very distinguished Indian painter, who told me this story about how when he was very young, I mean, this would be half a century ago now, it was actually at the time that my mother would have been pregnant with what turned out to be me, when he was hired by my parents literally to paint the nursery. And he was so broke, he was a serious artist, he was so broke that he
segued this into a portrait,
yes,
commission.
That's right. He managed to persuade my parents that he'd have a go at painting my mother. And he did so, and my father didn't like the picture and refused to buy it. And he was so much in need of the money for painting the nursery that he was unable to argue. So he left it with a friend, another painter called Hussein, who, also poor, at some point reused the canvas and painted a picture of his own over the top of it and flogged it. So then the two of them grow up to be the most, amongst the most distinguished contemporary Indian painters. And now somewhere rotating around India, probably in Bombay, is a Hussain painting with underneath it Krishan Khanna's painting of my mother.
Well, by now it may have a couple of other layers. Surfaces.
Yes, it may well. Who knows? You know.
You did try to find the painting.
I did try to find it. Yes, and indeed the BBC in England also helped in that they sent a film crew off to India to sort of search for it. But the problem is that Hussain, who I suspect knows where the picture is, isn't saying.
Oh, really?
So I think he's rather embarrassed by the whole story.
But it's better that it's not found, because now you can find it in the novel.
I must say, I've come to think that. I've come to think that it is quite possible, after all, that my father was right. I mean, it's quite possible that if we were to find the picture, it wouldn't be that good. It's kind of apprentice work of a young painter.
But he knew that you needed the story.
It may well be a long, a message in a bottle.
This isn't an immense leg pull. So this story is absolutely kosher.
It's absolutely true, and indeed, there are interviews with the painters concerned to say so. But it did certainly seem to be like a wonderful gift, this image of a lost painting, a portrait of a woman lost underneath the picture of a man. And so, it did become one of the ways of understanding this novel, because that metaphor of layering and loss is really very, very close to the heart of the book.
I think one of the reasons that people like you so much is that you have what I think Kundera just calls your revelation dimension. You write funny, don't you, as well as serious?
I hope so. I think it's one of the things that people, because the thing that happened to me was so dark, I think for a time it obscured in the public's mind the idea that there was actually a comic writer here.
A playful writer.
Yeah. I've often thought a very strange transference took place. I mean, because the attack was theological, people thought I must be a theological writer. Because the attack was black, people assumed I must be a very gloomy writer, and so on. So it's as if people's imagination, who didn't know my work, they came to think of my work as having the same characteristics as the attack against it. Whereas actually, I hope, it has the opposite characteristics. It was Kundera's essay, which was extremely flattering to me, and I think it was made the point about Rabelais. I love what we call today Rabelaisian. Actually, if you try to read Rabelais nowadays, he's very, very hard to read, because his work is so steeped in references and allusions and arcana of the period that unless you've got endless footnotes, you really don't know what he's talking about most of the time. But in his grand conceptions, he is, of course, a wonderful comic grotesque writer.
But humour, finally, is surely the only way, well, not the only way, but the best way, other than perhaps prayer, for those that can manage it, to deal with mortality, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
Isn't that what it's for?
Yes, well, I think humour is for everything, really. I think it is a way of facing up to death. It's a way of facing up to everything. So, on the other hand, it's to say that is I hear myself sounding a bit too functional, you know, because I think in the end, one of the great things about humour is that it's useless. You know,
in an evolutionary sense, it's a great puzzle, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. It has no point. You know, and I think if one reads, what is the point of P.G. Woodhouse?
But the point of humour for you is at least in part to create ambiguities, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I've tried to do in my writing is to create a voice or a way of writing or indeed a sentence which can begin in tragedy and end in farce, you know, where the slide between moods in the writing can happen at very, very great speed.
Not in the way that, say, Shakespeare might do it in the Scottish play, where suddenly in the middle of all the tragedy you've got the porter scene.
Mm-hmm.
Not by a complete shift.
No.
Do you want to do it within a paragraph?
Within a sentence, yes, exactly.
A syllable, perhaps.
Yes, yeah.
Working towards that.
Yes, I think this very fast sliding back and forth between comedy and tragedy, I think, somehow adds up to humanity. If you can do it.
Is it, I hate the term, is it a bit postmodernist too?
I don't know what that, yes, you see, I mean, again, because I'm not a student of English literature, my literary knowledge about postmodernism is a little magpie, you know, and I've obviously picked up bits of it here and there, but I don't have any systematic sense of it. I have a lot of problems with the term postmodernism, because it goes along with ideas like the death of the author and so on, which I believe not to have occurred.
But and it also assumes a sort of Greenwich Mean Standard for literature, which is operating somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in the sense that my writing has sometimes been self-conscious fiction, in the sense that it knows that it's writing itself and it discusses its own gestation while it's being written. I mean, that obviously is a part of the postmodern arsenal of weapons, but it's also a very ancient thing. I mean, you know, it struck me that if you and I were to sit down for an evening and tell each other stories, it would be absolutely natural and commonplace for us to comment, editorialize, if you like, on the stories we were telling. So that in the way in which human beings tell each other stories, it is perfectly natural for the teller to comment on the tale. Mm. Somehow, when you write this down, it looks strange and radical, and you have to find a kind of means for doing it. But actually, it seems to be the most natural thing to do.
Well, I can remember arguing that Dennis Potter's The Singing Detective was one of the most naturalist pieces of television I'd seen.
I agree.
Because all those things are happening in the way they do between the ears and the cyberspace of the head.
Exactly. And I think it comes back to this idea of writing as being a kind of conversation, you know, as being a conversation, first of all, an internal conversation inside the writer's head, and secondly, a conversation between the writer and the world.
Has anything good come out of this? Six and a half years. Has anything good come out of it? Have they learnt anything?
No, they haven't learnt a thing. Except perhaps they've learnt that that the values being defended here are a little more durable than they suspected. That people are in the end willing to stand up for them. I've learnt plenty, you know. I mean, and I think in that sense, some good has come out of it for me, in the sense that new information is always good for a writer.
But there's been no maturation process from them, capital the.
From the fundamentalists, I think really not. I don't think they're interested in having a conversation. I mean, they're simply interested in imposing their point of view.
Well, they've got a text, haven't they?
Yes.
That's it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm afraid in that sense it's been a kind of intellectual standoff. But I think what in between those, I mean, if you come away from fundamentalism, just in terms of society as a whole, I think you could actually say, in a strange way, that what happened to the Satanic Verses obliged a lot of people to know rather more about Islam than before, and that is no doubt a benefit. I think it's made a lot of people think, and that no doubt contains benefits. So I think, of course there are benefits in it. I mean, I remember when the Satanic Verses was published, one of the less good reviews it got from a very eminent woman critic in England, just to paraphrase it, it said something like, "What is all this material about Muslims doing in a novel about London?" And that was as well the degree of unknowing at that time, and now I guess she knows.
This is Philip Adams with another classic LNL, and I'm speaking to Salman Rushdie. A chat from 1995.
I remember watching some of the televised debates that raged at the time, and I remember Faye Weldon performing very well in a London debate. And Faye would not be shifted. She said, "Look, you know, our values, these things we hold to be sacred, have to be defended hotly." Now we live in a part of the world where we're constantly being told that we should modify our view on human rights, that this should be malleable and adaptable and adjustable, otherwise you're going to get into trouble with Indonesia or Beijing. How do you stand on that?
Well, I think that's dangerous nonsense, really, and it's to demonstrate it simply. Those countries in the world who are trying to push this line about human rights not being universal are the countries with the most authoritarian regimes. So, as Mandy Rice Davis said about...
They would say that, wouldn't they?
You know?
That's one of the great aphorisms, isn't it?
It is a great line. And it seems to me that, you mentioned the case of China, to accept that freedom is a relative value is really to insult the memory of those students who protested so extraordinarily in Tiananmen Square some years ago. People want freedom everywhere in the world. You know, freedom is not culturally specific as a value. And it is very, very dangerous and wrong, I think, for people who do live in free societies to fall into the trap of thinking that other societies are, by because of their culture, not destined to be free.
And one should remember, of course, that there was a time when Islam was the shining light,
yeah.
when Christianity was looking extremely very unpleasant.
So. And that's that one aspect of that is something that exists in the Moore's Last Sigh, because I use in it as a story the moment of the Arab period in Spain. And for a long time, the Arabs in Spain allowed to be created a composite culture, which was partly Muslim, partly Christian, partly Jewish, which was one of the glories of the world.
But hybrid cultures are always energetic, aren't they?
Yes.
I mean, you're a manifestation of that.
Yes, yes. I've always been in favour of hybrids. I've always said that I prefer mongrels to pedigree dogs, you know.
Well, cattle breeders will tell you of the phenomenon of hybrid vigour mm-hmm. as soon as you cross two streams. The progeny is invariably more energetic.
Yes, and I think it's one of the reasons I came to this is because I'm a city boy myself. I've spent most of my life in great cities, either in the East or in the West. And I think this phenomenon, the phenomenon of the hybrid, is a part of the natural phenomenon of living in the modern city. I think anybody who lives in a great city now, such as Sydney, will know that nobody has a pure culture anymore. There's all kinds of cultures jostling each other in the street, and you eat their food and you marry their offspring. And
that's true, but there's also one kind of culture being bombarded down from satellites.
Mm-hmm.
Do you share my concern with homogenized culture, with globalism?
Well, to an extent I do, because I think there is, you know, the incredible dominance of a rather small number of producers of this culture, you know, and I think that clearly is a worry. But, you know, there are some things, there are some demonstrations of the fact that local cultures actually are quite resistant. I mean, one example in India is that when they started beaming MTV down into India.
I often use this as an instance, yes, yeah.
They suddenly discovered that actually they couldn't, that people did not want to listen to endless diets of Western disco and Madonna. And they had to adapt the
fare. But the point is that they did hybridize that culture,
yes.
And Indian video clips are extraordinary. But there is still, day by day, hour by hour, mm-hmm. encroachments, aren't there?
And there's no question that's true. I mean, again, the only other positive thing I would say about the satellite revolution is that in India, again, until the satellite arrived, the broadcast media had been very, very tightly censored. I mean, very heavily censored, and produced nothing but the government line, and they were dull as ditchwater. The moment the satellite started beaming down, it revolutionized terrestrial television, which suddenly ceased to be censored, became much more open, much more interesting. And there was actually, I mean, one hates to say it, but there was a free speech benefit deriving from Murdoch there.
Dear, oh dear. you were talking about writers giving each other ideas. One of the ideas that's around at the moment is that the internet and the new technologies are the greatest gift to communication in the history of the planet. But before we look at that briefly, it seems to me that technology does affect the way people write, that it must have been quite different to sit with a quill dipping it into ink and scratching mm-hmm. it across a sheet of paper than it is, say, to use a ballpoint, an Olivetti, or a word processor. Do you think that technologies do fundamentally change the nature of the writing act?
The nature of the act, yes. The nature of the writing, I suspect, I'm not necessarily. I mean, that's to say, I've just made this switch. I mean, The Moore's Last Sigh is...
This is a confession?
Well, the Moore's Last Sigh is the first novel I've written on a word processor. I mean, until then, I used to type. And I was very suspicious of them. You know, and I'd heard all kinds of stories about how they made writing looser and more prolix and so on.
The curse of the cursor.
Yes, in my experience, it's I've had the opposite experience, really. I mean, my experience is that it allowed me to revise and tighten and strengthen what I was doing much more.
You've become a fiddler.
Well, put it like this: it removes, because it removes the tiresome physical act of retyping. It allowed me, I think, to spend more time on the imaginative act, and I mean, I do think that. Whatever else one may think about The Moore's Last Sigh, I do feel that it is the most polished piece of writing I've ever done, and there is no doubt in my mind that a part of that is because I've been able to revise so much more.
Do you believe that the new technologies will turn the millions into artists?
No. No, nothing turns the millions into artists. You know, I think there are always a relatively small number of artists. What it may make possible is new kinds of art. I mean, that's, you know, every time there's a new technology, there will be new artistic uses of it, and it may well be that creates new artists. I mean, different artists who are able to respond imaginatively to the new technology. I mean, I can't see anything I could do on the internet that's of any use to anyone. But there are people, because I don't just...
You could have a website, couldn't you?
I could have a website, but what would I do with it?
We could all send you messages.
Yeah, I know, but, you know, messages are...
Look, there's hundreds of people out there who want to send you messages on your on your website.
On my little website. Well, the day I get a website, I'll let you all know. But I have no particular urge to be online, as they say.
Me either.
But somebody will, and somebody will make great creative use of it, and we just don't know how yet.
You drop in references to science. You were talking before about the uncertainty theory. What sort of hope should human beings have? If we can't have the hope of progress, if we can't have that hope, what can we replace it with?
Well, being nicer to each other. I think there is a kind of hope which is represented by peace processes, that's to say. I mean, I think it is not true that there has been no progress. I mean, I think that if you compare ordinary human life 100 years ago, with ordinary human life now, there has been enormous progress. And so what I'm saying is the myth of progress is rather different from that. It's the idea that we would all be better off in some way that people feel has not happened. And that's to say, people in a way don't notice what has happened. So of course there will continue to be that kind of technological improvement. I mean, I would say that one of the great hopes for human beings is just in the increase of knowledge. You know, and I think that we know more.
That's a good hope, isn't it?
Yeah, we know more. We know infinitely more, you know, about our bodies, about
our history,
about our minds, about our history, about how we can live in the world, about the world, about the earth. We know a lot more than our grandfathers knew or our grandparents knew.
We don't know where that portrait is, though, do we?
No, we do not. But there must be some mysteries. I mean, I think it's a very good idea not to solve all one's problems.
Yeah, you read a little bit of science, I guess.
Popular science. I mean, there was a point at which the plan for me was that I was supposed to be a physicist. I mean, I didn't know this. When I did my O levels, my best O levels were maths and physics, and that was the plan.
That's because Indians are good at physics. You see, that's a little bit of stereotyping.
Yes, that's right. That's, well, I conformed to that stereotype, except that I then rebelled, and instead of doing maths and physics, I switched over to history and languages, and have never regretted it, except I do have a sort of hankering regret about physics, because I do think that the kind of brilliant discoveries being made, it seems like every day,
are there. Yeah.
And I think...
If I could have my life over again, I think I'd like to be a physicist.
Yeah, I think certainly even the great philosophical innovations that we now have in the world arise out of the knowledge that is coming to us about the nature of the universe on the one hand, and the nature of the particle on the other hand. So very big science and very little science turn out to be rather similar and rather poetic. You know, the idea of these particles with these wonderful names, you know, charm and so on, particles that may be also waves. I mean, these are completely metaphysical concepts. The idea that a thing may be solid or it may not be. Or that it can be both.
They suit you, these little concepts, don't they?
Yeah, and it's interesting. I've found a lot of contemporary writers that I know, certainly in Britain, I mean, writers like Martin Amis and Ian McEwan and myself, have become really gripped by this new science, because it seems to be where a lot of the new ideas are.
That was the voice of Salman Rushdie, recorded in November 1995, following the release of The Moor's Last Sigh.
It's easier than ever to hear your favourite local and national ABC radio stations, live and on demand on the ABC Listen app.